Let's get into today's show. One of the few congresspersons in Washington, D.C. who represents the people had an idea for achieving health care for all. Here's his proposal. A new movement, Health Care as a Civil Right. It's by Dennis Kucinich. In case you remember him, Dennis Kucinich is one of the few good guys in the Congress. Dear friends, there's only one true health care public option, single payer. It covers everyone, all basic health care needs with doctor of choice. No more premiums, copays, or deductibles. All healthcare assets in America would become not for profit. The bill already exists. It's H.R. 676. Congressman John Connors and I wrote that bill. Our bill has the support of 85 co-sponsors in the House, and it's backed by a growing national movement of labor, doctors, and nurses. The movement needs you. The hour has arrived to begin anew the civil rights movement, this time for health care for all. I'm calling upon you to become a force in this movement. Go to healthcare as a civil right at kucinich.us to learn how you can circulate a single-payer petition and organize in your community. Please help fund this effort. Go to kucinich.us now and contribute. The preamble to the United States Constitution and Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution both describe an originating purpose of our United States, to promote the general welfare. Health care is a legitimate function of our government. Health care is a basic right in a democratic society. It is no more a privilege based on ability to pay than is the right to vote, which was once accorded only to property owners. Health care is also a moral imperative. 47 million Americans are uninsured. 50 million Americans are underinsured. People are losing their homes, their jobs, their life savings, their retirement security, and their financial health because they cannot pay medical bills. And despite this calamity, Washington looks another way. We must not avert our eyes to this human suffering and this economic injustice. Let's prepare a response which Washington will long remember as the time when the people reclaimed their government from the insurance and pharmaceutical companies. Join us. Contribute. Together we can initiate an action plan to intervene and provide health care for all. A national health care for all conference call... Oh, that's already passed. Okay, there is an online petition if you're interested. So if you're interested in this effort, then you should contact kucinich.us. And there's a related story. Let me dive through papers and see if I can find it. So you'll have to amuse yourself for a few seconds. Here we are. Ha! I found it. Fort Collins, Colorado. It's by Bobby McGill, writing in the Fort Collins Coloradoan. With a set of protest songs kicking off the festivities, about 300 people turned out at Civic Center Park to hear why some local physicians and the mad-as-hell doctors from Oregon and Washington are angry about the United States healthcare system and the insurance companies associated with it. The mad-as-hell doctors are on a 20-stop tour of the country while on their way to Washington, D.C., where they will rally at the Capitol to encourage Congress to pass a bill instituting single-payer healthcare system. Unlike other recent health care rallies in Larimer County, there was no counter-protest from health care reform opponents. The doctors told stories of patients who chose not to get necessary treatment because they lost their insurance, and of hospitals that demanded doctors see patients only for one ailment at a time, when they might actually be suffering from several. A doctor of Port Townsend, Washington, said she was fired when she began speaking out about her small hospital's immoral mandate from Congress, forcing her to see patients for only one problem when many needed much more medical attention. "I'm still talking to Congress," she said. "I want my government back. I'm mad as hell." Inspired by the 1976 film Network, rally organizers urged their audience to vent its anger by yelling, "I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore." A doctor of Portland, Oregon, said the code words of the right wing, "socialized medicine, government takeover, personal responsibility," mean that those who oppose health care reform really don't want to help those in need and don't believe others deserve such public assistance. What happened to the family values of these people? He asked. Have they forgotten the family of man? Have they forgotten about our fellow Americans? That's why I'm mad as hell. The inability of patients to obtain adequate health care is a tragedy that's happening now, and we're not fixing it. This was spoken by another physician, who urged the audience to call their representatives in Congress and demand a single-payer system immediately. A Colorado physician said the local doctors who attended the rally represent many local doctors who know the health care system is broken. He recounted a meeting of the Colorado Medical Society this weekend in Breckenridge, where the topic was the increasingly difficult challenge of private primary care practices to just being able to stay in business. He said that the insurance company-influenced health care system is destroying primary care, and the 24 primary care physician offices were shuttered in that county alone in the last 4 years. He scoffed at health care reform's opponents' derision of single-payer system proposals and said their accusations that such a system runs counter to American ideals is nonsense. This system is un-American, he said. The most patriotic thing you can do, folks, is get a single-payer system in. The rally was filmed, and a video of it will be available on YouTube and other social networking sites, linked from the Mad as Hell Doctors website. For more information on Mad as Hell Doctors, visit www.madashelldoctors.com. Here's one from BBC News. Venezuela has agreed to export petrol to Iran in a sign of closer ties between two of America's most vocal adversaries. At the end of a two-day visit to Iran, President Hugo Chavez said Venezuela would supply 20,000 barrels of petrol a day to the country. Iran is a major oil exporter, but lacks domestic refining capability. Mr. Chavez has been using Venezuela's oil wealth to counter U.S. influence in Latin America and to boost ties with nations not friendly with Washington. He was quoted by Iranian media as saying, Venezuela has agreed to export 20,000 barrels of oil daily to Iran from October in a deal worth $800 million. He added this amount will be deposited in a fund established in Iran and will be used to finance purchase of machinery and technology from Iran. Iran has come under increasing pressure to give up its nuclear ambitions, with President Obama setting a dateline of later this month for Iran to engage in talks or face sanctions. The West suspects Iran is secretly trying to build nuclear weapons while Tehran insists its program is solely peaceful. My comment. Something is weird here. The stated reason for shipping oil across a large ocean to a country that has some of the largest deposits of oil on the planet is that Iran has, quote, it's a major oil supplier but lacks domestic refinery capability, close quote. But isn't Iran on the Western quasi-democracy's S list because they're trying to develop nuclear power? Why don't they instead build oil refineries to refine their own crude and obviate the need for nuclear power and avoid the West sanctions and possible air attacks from Israel? Is there any logic in this at all? One also has to question exactly what machinery and technology Venezuela will receive from Iran. Next article. Just in case you were wondering how Washington, D.C. politics really function in this, our bastion of democracy, this article might elucidate. It's from the Center for Public Integrity. It's called the Murtha Method. 12 of 16 House Defense Subcommittee members from 11 states are involved in controversial circles of lobbyists, earmarks, and campaign cash. Following up on allegations of influence peddling involving Representative John Murtha of Pennsylvania, who is chairman of the powerful House Appropriations Defense Subcommittee, a Center for Public Integrity computer analysis reveals that three-quarters of his subcommittee's members have been involved in similar patterns of behavior that include 16 former aides turned lobbyists, $100 million in earmarks, and $1 million in campaign cash. Amongst those involved are members of Congress from Florida, Georgia, Indiana, Kansas, Mississippi, New Jersey, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Texas, Virginia, and Washington. For months, a cloud has swirled around Murtha and the relationships that he and other subcommittee members had with a lobbying firm filled with former subcommittee aides. Aspects of those relationships are the subject of a Justice Department probe, which is thought to be looking at whether there were explicit quid pro quo exchanges of favors for cash, which would make crimes out of relationships that are otherwise legal. The House Ethics Committee is also looking at the situation. The center's analysis revealed that 12 of the 16 subcommittee members have been involved in similar circles of relationships fraught with potential conflicts of interest. In these circles, former staffers became lobbyists for defense contractors. The contractors received earmarks from the representatives, and the representatives received campaign contributions from the lobbyists or the contractors. The center's analysis, which covered fiscal year 2008, found these relationship circles included 11 lobbying firms and more than 50 earmarks totaling over $100 million. Along with Murtha, Peter Wisklowski of Indiana and Jim Moran of Virginia, who have already attracted scrutiny, the list includes ranking Republican C.W. Bill Young of Florida, Jack Kingston of Georgia. Now, I'm not going to read all the names. One of them retired at the end of last year, and another became a senator, but all the others remain members of this very important subcommittee. The lobbyists, the House members, and the companies that received earmarks say the relationships are entirely legal, and none of the representatives has been charged with wrongdoing. But government reform groups say the practices represent the worst of Washington's revolving door culture and are little more than legalized corruption. What a surprise. Next article is by David Swanson. It's reprinted from globalresearch.com. Army Shopping Mall Game Center shut down by protests. The Army Experience Center, an amusement hall built in a Philadelphia-area shopping mall to make killing and dying look like fun to kids, has been the focus of repeated protests and criticism. This past weekend, hundreds again protested at the AEC, and police arrested six protesters and one journalist. The journalist was not with the protesters and was picked out of a crowd, apparently because of her professional camera. Days prior to this long-planned and publicly announced protest, the Army announced that it would probably be closing the AEC. The AEC is this Army Experience Center. And not opening others in other shopping malls as had been planned. The reason? Are you ready to hear this? Wait for it. The Army doesn't need any more recruits because the bad economy has driven up recruitment significantly. Now, the grain of truth in this is that the economy has driven up recruitment. The whopper of a lie is that the Army could ever be satisfied with its recruitment numbers and not want more. And the glaring omission is the protests. Protesters should not fall for this. The Army will not announce our victories for us. We have to claim them. We drove Alberto Gonzalez out of town. We made the Iraq War illegal by turning the United Nations against it. We've held back military recruitment. We've prevented an attack on Iran by exposing the lies about Iraq. We scared Bush away from pardoning his subordinates' crimes. We have turned the American people against wars of empire, and we have made the Army Experience Center a bad experience for the Army. Seven were arrested, six of whom were consciously and knowingly resisting arrest. The seventh, Cheryl Barron, was covering the event as a journalist for Op-Ed News. The police came away from those risking arrest and picked Barron out of a crowd of onlookers to arrest her, possibly because she had a professional camera. She did not have a shirt or sign or anything associated with the activists. She made it clear that she was a journalist. Then she and the other five women spent the night in the Roundhouse, the central jail in Philadelphia. Barron told opednews.com, "The images that are most critical to me as a photographer and reporter are those at the end of protesters being arrested. Trying to prevent me from or punishing me for taking them reminds me of Bush not allowing photos of the caskets of dead bodies coming home from war. The way in which they try to prevent us from recording this kind of news in the making is shameful. It's anti-democracy. I stand by what I did." Rightly so, and all those who participated and the six who risked arrest are heroes as well. "The actions against me were violent and vengeful," she told the reporter. "A police officer rushed me from the side suddenly where I couldn't see him approaching and pulled me forcefully into the line of protesters. Later, another officer had to physically pull this officer off of me because he was so incredibly aggressive and enraged. I'm convinced it was because I was taking pictures of the arrests. Is anyone mystified by Wall Street recovering so quickly from economic catastrophe while the rest of us are still suffering? Perhaps this will offer some insight. It's by Jason Lidkins, writing in HuffingtonPost.com. He calls it casino capitalism. Fortune editor Andy Serwar says administration gaming the system for Wall Street titans. Earlier this morning, Morning Joe's Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski were joined by Fortune magazine managing editor Andrew Serwar and our own co-founder, editor-in-chief Arianna Huffington in Carlsbad, California at the Fortune magazine Most Powerful Woman Summit to talk about how Wall Street has fared in the age of bailouts. Asked about Goldman Sachs and their post-TARP fortune, Serwar used a pretty telling metaphor. Serwar, I mean, it's amazing to me that as we recover, you know, come out of this financial crisis, you know, you'd expect a company like Goldman Sachs, maybe things are improving, maybe they make a little money. But they have a record quarter. In other words, they made more money in this three-month period than they'd ever made in any other. Scarborough, archly. But they just made some good guesses, right? Serwar, well, I don't know if it's okay or not, but I think what happened is that the government has telegraphed to Wall Street, not only Goldman Sachs, but the other firms, what it was doing, what was going on, what the program was, and so essentially, it's like telling a Goldman Sachs, hey, put your money on black 32 at the casino, at the roulette wheel, and the thing spins, and lo and behold, where does it end up, Joe? Black 32. Yep, black 32. That's a pretty significant statement from the managing editor of a magazine that's going to have Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein present the Goldman Sachs and Fortune Global Women's Leader Award at this very summit. And it's hard to ignore the fact what Serwar describes is a risk-free system of wealth accumulation that bears no real working resemblance to the thing we know of as capitalism. Remember back to the 2008 campaign when so many people worried about wealth redistribution? Turns out the worry was very real, but the worriers themselves are all making out pretty well. The time, 26 minutes after noon. The place, Nevada City, California. The radio station's KVMR FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. The radio show is Rabble Rousing, your host, Chamba Lane. Oh, and some listener pointed out that I pronounced my name so fast that he thought my name was John Belaine. It's Chamba Lane. There you are. Okay, a listener called in recently wanting to know about teabaggers. He thought they might represent his concerns about the Obama leadership. And perhaps this will enlighten him and others. It's called Teabaggers, Seething Hate and Shameful Hypocrisy. It's by Bill Hare, writing in opednews.com. The teabaggers turned out for a major Washington, D.C. demonstration September 12th and displayed the seething hate and shameful hypocrisy for which the movement has become infamous. Two notable elements of the demonstration and the explanations on television and radio that followed from their supporters on their significance were the economic perils America currently faces, along with sympathy for the nation's middle class for the beating it's taking. How interesting that these teabagger events began after Democratic President Barack Obama took office. America already had compiled over a $10 trillion debt before Obama and a Democratic Congress assumed office. Who was minding the store when the U.S. debt became the highest in the history of the planet? How did this come to pass? Remember those tax cut bills and how they dismembered so many of those folks out there in America's heartland whose plights teabaggers proclaimed to be so concerned about? At the time that food banks were overwhelmed, unemployment increased, and more Americans had economically descended to poverty levels, just where were today's teabaggers? Where was this concern now being displayed about the economic tragedies encountered by so many Americans? Remember what the response was from the same spectrum of the political barometer that comprises today's teabag movement? How many times were the face of 9/11 hurled at progressives concerned about the tragedies confronting so many Americans? They would use 9/11 to accuse those registering the same concerns they suddenly discovered after Obama took office of disloyalty. No criticism was allowed of the Bush-Cheney team, since America was at war. Any criticism of any kind involved giving aid and comfort to the enemy. Oddly enough, there was no interest evidenced in independently investigating the same 9/11 Twin Tower tragedies that led to this state of war. It was also never explained how the war powers of the U.S. Constitution circumscribed that such a declaration must be invoked against a specific nation or nations. How many teabaggers at Saturdays and other meetings have carried signs referring to Obama as a Nazi? Were these wholesome expressions of good old American grassroots protest? On the subject of what constitutes totalitarian tyranny, based on the Nuremberg trials of Nazi war criminals following World War II, the major thrust of the U.S. prosecution team, led by Chief Justice Robert Jackson and Telford Taylor, was the act of waging aggressive warfare without the legitimacy of self-defense. What happened when this very thing occurred with George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld attacking Iraq and waging war without sufficient proof, inflicting death on more than 1.3 million Iraqis, while another 2 million became refugees? How did these individuals now calling Obama a Nazi react when a Swedish UN weapons inspector, along with the governments of France and Germany, sought sufficient time to investigate Bush-Cheney claims that the U.S. stood in imminent peril of a nuclear attack from Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein? All of the aforementioned nations and their leaders were referred to by the same mentality that comprises the current teabagger movement as wimps, while Air Force One sent a message to their Limbaugh Fox zealots by changing the name of its breakfast delicacy from French toast to more respectable patriotic freedom toast. Finally, observe how many teabaggers wear religion on their sleeves. This occurs within a climate of hurling steady invective at Obama, culminating with a vile Nazi label. Despite the verbal reverence displayed by teabaggers for Christianity, what about that forgotten book? There's a book that presumably embraced by Christians called the New Testament. It even referred to loving one's enemies, and it is said to embody the words and spirit of Christianity's founder. Are teabaggers following the example of Jesus Christ in the New Testament with their conduct? What about it, teabaggers? How can you be true Christians when you consistently shred the document on which Christianity's foundation is supposed to rest? Bill Hare, writing in opednews.com. South Carolina Congressman Joe Wilson was the guy who came out of obscurity recently by shouting out, "You lie!" while President Obama was addressing Congress on health care reform. And then he sort of, offered a half-assed apology. So who is this guy? Well, here's one journalist's opinion. Gordon Duff is a Marine combat veteran and a regular contributor to Veterans Today, SalamNews.com. A news organization staffed by a number of veterans, particularly former U.S. Marines. Here's his take. State Lines, Cincinnati, Ohio. Joe Wilson, real name Addison, presents himself as a hard-boiled combat veteran, retired Army colonel, and all-around tough guy. He belongs to white supremacist organizations. He fought hard to keep the Confederate flag in South Carolina, and when an aide to the notorious racist Strom Thurmond admitted that Thurmond had a half-African-American daughter, Wilson abused and threatened the woman in an attempt to shut her up. His real record is Vietnam. Born in 1947, Wilson was a prime material for the Vietnam War. After taking deferment after deferment for college and law school, in 1972, Wilson was glided into a coveted Army Reserve billet, protecting him from service in Vietnam. He quit in 1975 with the fall of Saigon and transferred to the National Guard, where he was a judge advocate, a lawyer. Wilson is one of the worst veteran records in Congress, having voted against veteran funding 11 times. The only veteran Wilson has helped is himself. Though ending up with full health insurance and a fat military retirement, Joe Wilson passed over more qualified serving officers who were deployed to combat and he moved into a high-paying position as full colonel, all done using political clout. This gives Wilson substantial double-dip retirements without ever having to actually serve in the real military, and especially not during a war. Wilson's opponent in the upcoming election is Rob Miller, 13-year Marine veteran with 2 combat tours in Iraq. But Wilson missed his chance at combat due to more important considerations involving personal skin. Wilson, close friend and confidant of Fox Entertainment reality show host Glenn Beck, is a strong advocate of private health care. In fact, he received over $400,000 in political donations from the health care industry in support of his position. Insiders say that Beck helped stage the Wilson impromptu theater during the president's address to Congress, offering full support from Fox News in exchange for Wilson's violation of traditional Southern good manners, something Wilson has little familiarity with. Wilson has spent a lifetime on the public payroll running his mouth, while others have done the fighting. My comment. So that's Joe Wilson, the latest hero of Glenn Beck. Thank you, South Carolina, for sending this sterling representative to Congress. With guys like this voting, is it any wonder that Congress fiddles while the nation burns? Next article is by Robert Borosage, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. It's from Huffington Post. He calls it Obama's September choice, charge or trim. As Congress returns from its summer recess, President Obama, slipping in the polls, assailed on all sides by all carpers, faces a strategic choice: lead the charge, rally Democrats, and push forward on his agenda, starting with health care reform, or trim his sails and adopt a more cautious course. David Brooks, the keeper of conservative convention, sounds the call for retreat in his New York Times column. Brooks, who peddles conservative pieties with a soft voice and smile, has packaged himself as the reasonable Republican. This has made him the darling of mainstream opinion, a pundit far more prominent than profound. But he is consistent. When he begins ladling out advice to Democrats, he's unerringly in error. Brooks argues that Obama has gone astray because he joined himself at the hip to the liberal leadership in Congress. I've got to interrupt with a comment. What liberal leadership in Congress? Back to the article. His slide in opinion polls comes from prominent policies that increase spending and centralize power in Washington. Obama must learn that fiscal responsibility is the animating issue of American moderates. So Obama would be well advised to return to the central values of America: fiscal restraint, individual choice, and decentralized authority. Well, few would object to those desirables, but before Brooks' advice congeals into conventional wisdom, it's worth noting that it is truly BS. Yes, Obama has suffered a slide in the polls since the afterglow of his election. Much of this was to be expected once he started trying to clean up the devastation left by George Bush. Becoming president as Americans lose some $13 trillion in assets, and see how long your popularity holds up, no matter what course you follow. But in these ruins, it's hardly fiscal responsibility that's the animating issue of American politics. Conservatives love to huckster this theme when they're out of power. Since Reagan, who, as Dick Cheney noted, taught us deficits don't matter, the right has followed a consistent path. In power, they cut top-end taxes, explode the military budget, and run up record deficits. Thrown out of power, they suddenly become chastened disciples of fiscal discipline, preaching against licentious spending, rending their garments in the name of balanced budgets, looking towards the day when they're returned to power to once more cut top-end taxes, explode the military budget, and run up record deficits. Just as Reagan doubled the national debt and ran up unprecedented deficits, which conservatives in both parties used to shackle the Clinton presidency, and just as Bush squandered the Clinton surplus and bequeaths a $1 trillion deficit to Obama. But the cynicism of this strategy wouldn't much matter if, in fact, it were true that voters were fixated on fiscal responsibility. No question, Americans are worried about deficits. How could they not be, given the media clamor about $9 trillion deficits, a figure tossed about unhinged from the reality that it represents a 10-year projection, during which time the economy will generate over $180 trillion in gross national product. But it is red ink that soured But is it red ink that has soured Americans on Obama's course? Or is it simply a metaphor for growing concerns about his economic policies? In fact, I'd argue that the two biggest drags on the president's popularity go without mention in the Brooks column. It isn't fiscal responsibility in the abstract. It's hundreds of billions going to bail out bankers and speculators who are now back to paying themselves million-dollar bonuses, bonuses about to be approved by the president's compensation czar, while factories close, homes are lost, hours and wages decline. Americans conflate the recovery plan, which is actually putting people to work, with a Wall Street bailout, which rewards the very people who drove us off the cliff. They aren't angry at big government in the abstract. They love Social Security and Medicare, two of the largest government social programs. They're angry at big government that spends their money to save Wall Street and not Main Street. Obama pays and will pay a continuing price for his decision to subsidize the banks and not reorganize them, to bail them out without firing those who led us into the mess. The other policy that will increasingly corrode trust in Obama is also absent from Brooks' column. It comes from dismissing liberals, not following them. That is the misadventure in Afghanistan. Liberal voices have been muted here, hoping against hope that Obama would find a way to extricate us before it's too late. But a significant part of Obama's slide in the polls comes from liberal and Democratic-leaning independents. Democratic leaders have always underestimated the depths of American discomfort with these adventures. Sure, no one wants al-Qaeda given a free pass, but this country is in trouble here at home. The vast majority of Obama supporters want out of Iraq and has no appetite for sending ever more troops to Afghanistan in the futile pursuit of nation-building. Hell, even conservative George Will has no stomach for that. Brooks suggests that it would be suicidal for the president and Democrats to press forward with health care reform without Republican support. In fact, the reverse is surely true. Democrats should have learned in 1994 that Americans will hold them responsible if they fail to produce. Republicans get this. That's why they've committed themselves to trying to break the Obama presidency by uniting to obstruct any reform. The president can't escape this test. Can he rally the disputatious Democratic senators to unite against the Republican filibuster, pass cloture with 60 votes, and then pass a health care plan through both houses of Congress with majority support? If Democrats unite against the filibuster, several so-called moderate Republicans, truly exotic birds, are likely to join in supporting the final bill, but not until then. And Democrats, if they pass a decent bill, will benefit greatly in 2010. Alternatively, they can follow Brooks' advice and run in the by-election with doubt, with double-digit unemployment and failed health care reform. Good luck. In the end, Brooks lives in a conservative fantasy world. Americans are suspicious of centralized government, he says, because this is a country that has just lived through an economic trauma caused by excessive spending and debt. More accurately, this is a country that has lived through an economic trauma caused by catastrophic financial deregulation and speculation, fueled by top-end tax cuts, a costly war of choice, a middle class holding on only by taking on greater debt, and an unsustainable global economic strategy based on borrowing $2 billion a day from abroad. Conservative policies and ideas drove us off the cliff. Getting the diagnosis wrong leads Brooks to the wrong prescription. Fiscal responsibility, individual choice, and decentralized authority. Bravo. But in the current situation, this translates into cutting spending, which would increase unemployment and deepen the recession, and foregoing re-regulation, which would allow Wall Street to go where they're already headed, back to gambling, now with taxpayers guaranteeing their losses. Obama's problem isn't that he's tied himself to liberal leadership in the Congress, which is surely an oxymoron in the Senate. It is that he appears to be straying from the promise that swept him into office. His great genius was to run a campaign that understood how much Americans wanted change. He presented himself as an outsider who would challenge the old ways of doing business, sweep the money changers from the temple, and take on the entrenched corporate lobbies. He pledged to get us out of Iraq and to bring the money home to invest in America. Is he suffering because he's followed that course? Or are doubts growing because he appears to be wavering, cowed by Wall Street, waltzing with the drug companies, getting rolled by oil and coal interests, squandering more resources and lives abroad, while talking about cutting Medicare and Social Security? Americans want this president to succeed. The majority that elected him want Washington changed. They want him to take on the entrenched special interests. They will punish those, particularly Democrats, who stand in his way. But they increasingly wonder if he is the champion they elected. Obama's leadership strategy, which is to emphasize compromise, elevate bipartisanship, put everyone in the table, blur lines of disagreement, does little to dispel those doubts. So as the president meets with his advisors this fall, he should remind them of what got him in the White House. He would benefit greatly from hewing not to Brooks' wrong-headed advice to trim his sails, but by boldly unfurling the principles and priorities that inspired the movement that swept him into office and stands ready to fight with him today. That was Robert L. Borosage, co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, writing in Huffington Post. And I will quote Bob Dylan. I just say good luck. Let's go to India. This is by Jane Stillwater, writing in smirkingchimp.com. It's originally from the Times of India. There's nothing called the moderate Taliban. Benazir Bhutto and the ISI, which is the CIA of Pakistan. Benazir Bhutto and the ISI did not create the Taliban in the winter of 1994 for war against America. Its purpose was to defeat fractious Afghan warlords and establish a totalitarian regime that it would equate Afghanistan's strategic interest to Pakistan's. The ISI conceived an AFPAC long before the idea reached the outer rim of Washington's thinking. Pakistan worked assiduously to widen the Taliban's legitimacy and would have drawn America into the fold through the oil pipeline siren song if Osama bin Laden had not blown every plan apart. I'll have to interrupt here to remind listeners that it was not Osama bin Laden that created 9/11. But back to the article. In some essentials, things have not changed. Pakistan's interests still lie in a pro-Islamabad Taliban regime in Kabul. The moderation theory is a ploy to provide war-weary America with an exit point. India's anxieties will be offered a smile in public and a shrug in private. History is uncomfortable with neat closures. Neither the Taliban nor Pakistan are what they were in 1994. The former is much stronger, the latter substantially weaker. The fall of Kabul to the Taliban this time could be a curtain raiser to the siege of Islamabad. By the way, in case anybody's interested, the mainstream media seems to be pronouncing it Kabul, but when I lived there, it was Kabul. So I don't know. The next section of our article offers another perspective on the reports of our troops killing civilians in Afghanistan. Give a listen, as you might not have heard this side of the story. I have no way to check the factuality of the writer's perspective, but she writes as if she knows what she's writing about. Here's an email I just received from yet another angry Marine mom. Afghanistan strategy sacrifices U.S. troops. Here's a quote from the speech Admiral Mullen delivered to our troops at Forward Operating Base Ramrod, Afghanistan, in July of this year. We cannot succeed here without taking care of the Afghan people first. We're heavily focused on making sure that we absolutely eliminate civilian casualties. You could be in a really hot firefight, but you need to be thinking how to get through that in a way that doesn't really hurt the overall effort strategically. Close quote. And in a statement published by the Joint Chiefs of Staff website, Admiral Mullen said, quote, the U.S. military in Afghanistan lacks credibility because the U.S. hasn't done enough to establish relationships with local communities, and its actions don't always match its words. Close quote. Way to go, Admiral. Put the blame on our troops for not having established good relationships. It's time for the Admiral to retire. The only way to absolutely eliminate civilian casualties is to leave Afghanistan, which, after 8 years of bungling, apologizing, and making solicitous payments to those shooting at our troops, may now be our only option. This method of leadership only creates fear and insecurity with our forces and is why the situation is continually deteriorating. The turning point was when we allowed the Afghans to falsely accuse a particular Marine company who had been hit by a suicide bomber and ambushed of killing civilians, and within 6 days ordered the entire company of 120 Spec Op Marines out of Afghanistan. We have too many risk-averse generals with little or no combat experience willing to destroy the troops under their command. Lieutenant General Francis Kearney III, the only combat experience General Kearney had was in Grenada, yet he was put in charge of special forces in Afghanistan. He ordered the entire company of Spec Op Marines out of Afghanistan. An experienced combat veteran would not have stated, quote, "There's no evidence the Marine Spec Ops platoon came under small arms fire after the bombing. We found no brass ammunition casings." Instead of investigating the suicide bomber and the source of the weapons and mortar bases found at the site, General Kearney ordered a criminal investigation of the Marines who were attacked. Kearney took the side of the insurgents who were firing on our troops. The problem with apologizing and making payments before any investigation is completed is that the Afghans take this as an admission of guilt, and these exaggerated false counts are broadcast around the world, enormously damaging our efforts. Army Colonel, now Brigadier General, John Nicholson. Nicholson publicly apologized to the Afghans, saying he was, quote, "deeply, deeply ashamed and terribly sorry that American Marines had killed and wounded innocent Afghan people. This is a terrible, terrible mistake," he said. "And my nation grieves with you for your loss and suffering. We humbly and respectfully ask for your forgiveness." And for the first time, he upped the number of dead from 10 to 19, based on no evidence but the word of the Afghans in this Taliban-controlled village, who he paid for their trouble. The military did not explain the discrepancy. Nicholson paid the families of the insurgents who fired on our troops. Brian Williams reports on an interview Jim Maceda had with Colonel Nicholson. By the end of his 2006 tour in eastern Afghanistan, Nicholson's unit had lost 45 men and 350 wounded, the highest U.S. toll in the war. Allowing the Afghans to falsely accuse our troops of killing civilians, he paid compensation for exaggerated false counts and unbelievably apologized, knowing it was fabrication. An Air Force colonel, chief of staff with no combat experience, was assigned to investigate. He recorded and took signed statements for all 29 Marines on the patrol. He also met with Army and Navy explosive ordnance disposal experts. The two experts filed their reports stating that the impacts on the vehicles were from small arms ammunition. The experts both testified that they were 99% positive the impacts could only have been from bullets. Both explosives experts testified that the colonel repeatedly met with them and attempted to have them resubmit their reports to reflect the impacts were from explosives, not from small arms. Both of the experts testified that they refused to comply with his request because they were sure of their original reports. After expelling the Marines from Afghanistan, Kearney was promoted to Lieutenant General and assigned to the Deputy Commander of U.S. Special Operations Command. Colonel Nickerson was promoted to Brigadier General and assigned Deputy Commander after he made false statements publicly. The U.S. Air Force Investigations Officer who conducted his shoddy investigation was rewarded this winter by a Distinguished Service Medal awarded from Lieutenant General Kearney. The various lists of supposed injured and dead civilians cannot be verified by any source. The Army did not check the Celestia list, instead accepted the list from the local governor. Afghan testimony contained numerous instances of fraud. Tribal elders told some citizens to say they were injured to receive money. Within 15 minutes of the attack, the first team of military police arrived on the scene. They saw no injured people or dead bodies other than the body parts of the suicide bomber. No bodies were recovered, there were no autopsies, no forensic evidence. These senior commanders were so fearful for their careers, should the American public be made aware of and scrutinize their military misadventures, they were willing to destroy and imprison innocent servicemen. As long as we continue to promote these risk-averse, self-seeking officers with little or no combat experience. We will continue to have weak leadership and unforgiving, stunning casualty rates. Our generals would do well to concentrate more on winning the war and less on blaming and prosecuting our troops. So, that's another side of the story. All right, not too much time left. We got time for this. Let's indulge in some wistful thinking. The author of the Falago article doesn't expect any of proposals to be implemented, but I enjoyed the fresh air of his thinking. It seems there are solutions if we only had courageous leadership. It's by Dave Lindhorff, writing in SmirkingShip.com. He calls it change we can't hope for, Obama's narrowing window of opportunity. The way I see it, President Obama has a couple of months to turn his failing administration around. The war in Afghanistan is going south, and within a couple of weeks, his general William Westmoreland, General Stanley McChrystal, will be coming to him asking for more troops. Things are getting hairier in Iraq, too. His signature health care initiative is foundering, with Republicans working in lockstep to see to it that it fails. Pressure is mounting for an honest probe into the criminality of the prior administration and in its authorization and promotion of torture against captives, most of them innocent, in the Bush-Cheney war on terror. The stock market, which by climbing back 50% from its collapse and the bottom it hit in March, gave the president a breather, is showing signs of exhaustion and is likely to start sinking again as investors realize there's no end in sight for the recession in the real economy. If all this continues into December, which is, after all, only a couple of months away, Congress will go into recess, and when it returns, it will be an election year, with all the House seats up for grabs and a third of the Senate also facing re-election. Republicans will be in an all-out campaign to reduce the Democratic majorities in both houses, with history on their side. In almost every off-year election, the party of new presidents lose support from both houses of Congress. So what's the president got to do? First, he needs to announce a bold peace initiative in Afghanistan. He should reject the call for more troops and instead call for a regional peace conference, one that would include all the neighboring countries around Afghanistan, and most significantly, the Taliban. At such a conference, he should arrange for a new government of national unity that includes the Taliban, and then get the hell out of the country. Obama can declare victory if he wants, but the main thing is to get out. Ditto for Iraq, where the U.S. is still viewed as an occupier and is going to be forced out eventually. There's no reason to stay one more day. Second, he should declare the dysfunctional and industry-polluted health reform plans in Congress dead and simply announce that by executive order, he's lowering the age for Medicare to 55 and is switching all Medicaid patients in the country over to Medicare with the intention of lowering that age by 5 years every year until everyone is covered, and shutting down the Medicaid program. He should then submit a bill to Congress establishing a government-owned insurance company, open to all, with no restrictions on its ability to set pricing and reimbursement rates or to negotiate discounts from hospitals, doctors, and pharmaceutical companies. Or alternatively, the bill could enable anyone to simply buy into Medicare. He should tell Democrats and Republicans alike that any member of Congress who votes against that bill will not see any bill with her or his name on it get his signature for his remaining years in office. The government company would be phased out once Medicare covered everyone. Finally, the president needs to announce that he's sickened by the information he's received about the prior administration's torture program and that he is encouraging his attorney general to fully investigate it and to prosecute to the full extent of the law anyone, no matter how high up in the military or the government, who authorized torture or who covered it up. Congress could be expected to howl at the use of an executive order to expand Medicare, but the president could declare a national health emergency as justification, saying the recession has thrown too many people off of health insurance, and that as well, states were in dire fiscal shape and laying off workers because of the increased Medicaid burden. Removing older workers from employers' health insurance plans would be a huge shot in the arm for struggling companies, as they are the biggest users of health care. Lifting the $400 billion cost of Medicare from state governments would free up money to prevent the layoff of state and local employees, which is threatening to stifle economic recovery. Republicans can be expected to denounce the president for going after the Bush-Cheney administration on torture, But most Americans at this point are becoming aware of the damage that the policy has caused to the country's international reputation and to the soldiers in the field. Many people would also howl about bringing the troops home from Afghanistan and Iraq, but the truth is that the vast majority of Americans are sick of both wars and would welcome an end to them. The key to all of these moves, however, is that Obama needs to explain them not in terms of saving money, but as being the right thing to do. Healthcare reform has to be presented as a moral imperative, not as a money saver, even though covering everyone with Medicare would be a huge net savings for everyone in the country. Ending America's foreign wars would be a huge savings, but the real reason to do it is that the U.S. has no business being a global cop and imperialistic occupier. And prosecuting torture is essential if the U.S. is to be a nation of laws. You wouldn't know it to listen to the jaded pundits in the corporate media, but in my experience, most Americans are basically decent people and would like to be the citizens of a country that did decent things, not just things that could be justified as making economic sense. I'm not expecting any of this to happen, of course. This president has shown repeatedly and convincingly